Right, so you are working at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany. Tell us a little bit about the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy, because it's one of those famous institutions in the world for doing astronomy.
Yes, okay. So what can I tell you about the Max Planck Institute? The first thing to mention is probably there's a lot of money. So this is a kind of a rich institution, so there's a lot of money. Then they have large computers, and so this is one of the main centers in the world doing computer simulations. So that's a good point to be there, because you can have the state-of-the-art simulations and work with them. And I'm very fortunate to be there.
That's probably so the main work of the institute is computational, do you think? I mean, does the institute run telescopes around the world like many other astronomy departments?
No, actually they don't. There are some observers, of course. So there's a connection between observers and theoretical physicists. But in general, it's mostly known for the computer simulations they do. And one of the projects was this Millennium simulation, which was done in 2004. And at that time, it was the biggest simulation done ever.
Okay. And what's it simulating?
The evolution of the matter distribution in the universe in a very coarse sense, because we do not, or this simulation does not take into account baryons or any baryonic processes. So all the things we can see with our telescopes this is based on baryonic physics, and this is not implemented, or this is not implemented in the first hand in this simulation. It only gives you an idea about the distribution of the overall matter in the universe, and the actual model is that only a few percent, let's say 15% of the gravitating matter is baryonic. So the rest of this matter is the so-called dark matter, and this is not visible. But for the purpose of simulation, it is enough just for the first stage, it is enough to just simulate the gravitating matter, and that's what's done with this Millennium simulation.
It's remarkable to note, we should remind ourselves what baryonic matter is. It's the stuff that you and I are made of, what stars are made of. As you said, the stuff that we can see in the universe is made of baryonic matter.
Right.
So protons, neutrons, stuff, matter. But as you say, as people have come to realize, most of the universe is not made of stuff that you and I are made of, what stars are made of. It's this so-called dark matter, which we cannot see, but we only know of because it interacts gravitationally with itself, presumably, and everything else. So it's interesting that the simulation, if you want to simulate the universe, as the Millennium simulation does, you have to simulate it predominantly by what the dark matter is doing.
Right, that's true. There are certain hints that the matter in the universe must be, or there must be, a huge amount of invisible matter. I mean, as you said, the baryonic matter, or why we see the baryonic matter is it is interacting electromagnetically. So light comes from baryonic matter, because electrons and protons were acting together, and then you get photons out of it, and these photons at the end come to our telescopes, and then you can see the stars, for example, or everything you see. It's due to electromagnetic interactions. And the dark matter seems to not interact electromagnetically. This is the reason why it's invisible. A good idea, or I always try to make it, it's hard for me to understand what's dark matter anyway, so but I think a good picture would be water, because you cannot, if you have a clear, really clear water where no dirt in it, then you would not see it, but still it's there and it's heavy. You would feel it. So instead of talking about dark matter, I would say it would make more sense to talk about invisible matter, but the course of history was different, and so now we talk about dark matter.
So the Millennium simulation, how does it simulate dark matter? Do you just say, well, it's all dark matter, we'll just have a big chunk of this fluid, this dark matter stuff, and then let it run and see what happens?
Yeah, that's basically what they do. They just ignore, as I said, it's mostly 15% of the whole gravitating matter is baryonic. The rest is dark. So these are 85% is dark. And in the Millennium simulation, now they just take 100% dark matter. So everything is just dark matter and they ignore the baryonic part. And this is well justified because one needs to ask the question where or when does dark matter and baryonic matter, when do they behave differently? And in most of the time of the universe, of the evolution of the universe, dark matter and baryonic matter just behaves the same. In terms, they all react only to gravity, and so they follow the same pattern of motion or whatever. But then, only at the late stages, if you have a huge density enhancement or huge accretion of matter, very dense, at very, very dense regions of the universe that would later become galaxies or clusters of galaxies, then you will see a difference between the behavior of baryonic matter and dark matter, because dark matter cannot radiate, so there's no electromagnetic radiation, whereas the baryonic matter can do it. And this is the reason why they differ. So but only in the very dense regions of the universe they are different, and this is at later stages in the evolution of the universe. So to a certain extent it's justified, or it is well justified, that you just use dark matter to get an impression of what's happening in the universe.
So how far back does the Millennium simulation go when it starts simulating the universe?
Let's say this is about they start at a redshift, so astronomers say that's a redshift of, I think, 170, about this. This is about few hundred thousand years of the universe, age of the universe, and they do start this simulation.
So not long after the Big Bang. Universally speaking, not long after the Big Bang.
No, quite short time after the Big Bang. Yes, that's true.
Mm. We should mention who did the Millennium simulation.
This is basically done by the people at MPA. This is Volker Springel is responsible for that. Simon White is one is behind all this, doing the preparation. But there are other people involved in. You need to have a code to run these simulations, and this Millennium simulations is run with a code called Gadget, and it was mainly developed by Volker. But there are some other guys. I forgot the name, of course. Sorry.
Not to worry. We can put links to the Millennium simulation on our website. So people who really want to know the details about who did what, they can check that out. But it was a remarkable effort. It took, obviously many people a long time to write the code. I mean, simulating the universe is no mean feat. And it certainly took, a lot of computers, a lot of time to churn the numbers out. But now, can anybody access the Millennium simulation data?
Yeah, they are publicly available. There's a database. Probably we can put the link there too. It's on Max Planck. Everybody can download the data. Of course, the Millennium simulation computed the evolution of the universe starting from these early times to the current epoch, and the output of these simulations is stored in 64 snapshots, so-called snapshots. And each of these snapshots, pure data, would be about 30 gigabyte, I think. So it is not. And now, if you want to download this data on the web, it's just infeasible. So the data have to be prepared. So what you can download is, for example, a Halo catalog. So people, if you have the raw data, this is of 10 billion particles, you have the positions and the velocities in this box, in this simulation box, which has a huge cosmic volume. So you have the positions and the velocities of 10 billion particles. And of course, this is difficult to deal with. And so the people at MPA did some pre-processing. And for example, they tried to find the groups, the dense regions in this simulation. So, and this is what you in the end can download. You can, for example, download a catalog of this so-called halos, the dense regions in this simulation. And therefore, for each halo, you only need three numbers for the position and three numbers for the for the velocity. So that's all you need to characterize this halo. And this is already comprising, let's say, a million of particles or so. So this is a way how you can reduce the data and still have very, very, useful information, which you then can download on the web.
Mm. So you yourself are using the Millennium Simulation. You were involved in producing the Millennium Simulation as it is, but you are using the results of the Millennium Simulation. What are you using the simulation for?
Well, I do want the people that cannot use. I go back to the raw data because.
Because you're there, aren't you? You're at the MPA, right. So you don't need to worry about transfer times and stuff.
Yeah, that's the case, and that's the interesting thing. What the public can get or. What's publicly available has to, or it's necessarily reduced to make it transferable, to make the data, to reduce the data size. So, of course, you cannot store every detail because then the amount of data would be as large as the simulation itself. So that's the reason why you cannot, why not all things are available in on the public database. And what I am doing is, I go back to the raw data. I look at these halos I talked about before. So this, this group of, dense particles. And I am interested in the shape of these objects. So in general, the only thing which is playing a role is, gravity. So these are particles which are at the beginning of the simulation. They are more or less smoothly distributed, and then after a few billion years, during the evolution of the universe, some of these particles are gathered in very, very dense environments. So they are attracted by gravity, and so they build the so-called halos. And I'm interested in the shape of these halos. So therefore, I go back to the raw data, get the positions of all the particles within one halo, and then I compute the shape of these objects. After computing the shape, that's not all. So that's interesting per se to know how a dark matter halo looks like. I mean, is it spherical, for example, or does it look like a pancake, or is it more or less cigar shaped? Or so this is interesting per se, but it's not the thing I'm interested in. This is more or less a byproduct of what I'm doing. But the thing then is I'm interested, how is this shape of the halo related to the overall matter distribution?
So all the galaxies that we know of in the universe are encased in one of these dark matter halos.
Yes. Okay. This is what you have to know about the Millennium Simulation as well. The simulation is not as, and it's not, or at its time, it was not just the biggest simulation in number of particles. It was, the good thing about the Millennium Simulation was that they provided a publicly available semi-analytical galaxy catalog. And that's the interesting thing. We talked about before, it is just dark matter what the simulation provides. But then if you have some idea how to populate this dark matter with galaxies, then you can do it in an analytical way. And that is, so the simulation is done, then you go back and look how the halos in the simulation, all this dense matter lumps, have evolved over time. And if you have an idea what the baryonic matter should have done within these halos, you can artificially create or populate these dark matter halos with galaxies. And this is a very good point. If you have galaxies, then you can, this facilitates the comparison to observation. And this is a very, very good advantage of the Millennium Simulation, that you have on the one side this very sophisticated dark matter simulation, but on the other side you have the model galaxies, which makes it easy to compare to observations.
How would you know which galaxy goes into which halo? So you've got your little families of model galaxies, and you've got the dark matter simulation with a whole pile of halos. How do you choose which galaxy goes into which halo?
Well, okay. So in general, the evolution, or we now call it hierarchical evolution of structure, it starts out with small lumps of dark matter, and they do increase, or they accrete other material, and so they do increase and become larger and larger, and up to the to the current time if, when they achieve cluster sizes or whatever. So the main point is you start out with very small objects and they accrete matter and they get bigger and bigger. And now you follow this path of accretion, this path of growth, and you know whenever a dark matter lump is falling into this this already existing system or object, then it brings some certain amount of baryonic matter. We talked about this 15%, so that means 15% of baryons come in with this dark matter lump, and that's of course this is not within the simulation, but you can say we know that it must be the case. And so you can build up galaxies. So whenever baryonic matter is coming with an accretion of another protohalo, that means you think about what should happen to the baryons within this accreted matter. And then you say, well, part of this halos, part of this baryons probably go and form the galaxy. Or if there's already a galaxy at the center of these halos, then they increase this galaxy. They trigger star formation or things like this. So they help the galaxies to evolve. And this is an analytical approach. And so you can, from the beginning, from this very, very small seeds of dark matter halos, you populate this with initial, let's say, core galaxies, and then they evolve over the whole time of the whole course of the universe.
So they effectively separated out the galaxy formation from the Millennium simulation of dark matter. So you know what a galaxy will do in terms of its baryonic matter during its evolution, or at least you think you know from your
right.
analytic models. And you go, well, this is what happened in the Millennium simulation in terms of the dark matter. So we just do the galaxy calculation in parallel, I guess you could think of it, on the side. And once that galaxy is, or that those types of galaxies have been evolved according to how you think they should be evolved, then you can just plot them into the dark matter halos that you have in the Millennium simulation.
Right, exactly. That's true. So you have the dark matter simulation was done before, and you have all the data stored. So you have this 64 outputs or snapshots. You get the merging history for each halo within this snapshot. So you know how this dark matter halo evolved. And then afterwards, if this is done, you populate this so-called merging trees with galaxies. And the good thing about this is that you can apply different models of galaxy evolution. So, and this can be done very fast. So, to switch some parameters in your models, it just takes you a few hours computing time, and then you have a total new galaxy population with this total new parameters, but you don't need to run the whole simulation again. And this is it's a big advantage, as if you would compute, if you would change some parameters, if you would have to change some parameters because you learned some more or some observation came up, so you have to twist your parameters. And in one case, if you don't have stored all the dark matter data, you would have to run the whole simulation again. But that's not the case. You can't just fiddle mm-hmm. around and then just run the semi-analytical models again, which is much less computational effort than running the whole simulation.
Yeah. We should talk about the difference between a numerical simulation, which is what the Millennium simulation is, and what we're talking about here with the galaxy formation, which is an analytical process. An analytical process simply is the solution of a whole bunch of equations, basically, which can be done relatively quickly. Whereas a numerical simulation is, well, it's a brute force technique, isn't it? Pretty much there are no equations to solve, or rather there are so many of them that it is impossible to do so. So you have to work out almost, well, effectively by hand, I suppose one way of thinking of it is the interactions between two pairs of particles in the simulation again and again and again and again.
Right. To a certain extent, the dark matter simulations are pretty simple because you have only one law. This is the law, the Newton law of gravity. So that's all. The force between two particles is proportional to the product of the two masses divided by the distance squared. So that's very simple, and that's the basic law which is implemented in the simulations. So for each particle, you find the neighbors, and then you compute this force and sum it up, and the resulting force is, according to the resulting force, you move your particle. And this you do for all the particles. And the trick here now is that you want to do it for 10 billions of particles. And so the main challenge is to reduce computational time. So you cannot do it particle by particle, because that would just take ages. So you need to have more sophisticated approaches to do this kind of integration. But in principle, it's very simple.
So now that you've got a more complete picture of the universe by picking your model galaxies, and you've plugged them into your corresponding dark matter halos from the Millennium simulation. This is all assuming that the two processes are independent, that the galaxy formation doesn't affect the dark matter evolution and vice versa. Is that a big worry, or, as you mentioned right at the beginning, do we not worry about this in the first case?
As the simulation is set up, we... We are not allowed to worry about this. No. No, of course. There is some back reaction between baryons and dark matter, in particular in dense regions where the baryons, as I said, behave differently than the dark matter. For example, radiation. I just give an example of clusters of galaxies. In the visible, or if you look with the telescopes, you see a bunch of galaxies which are very close together. Now, in the 1930s, Zwicky, I think, the astronomer, I forgot the first name, Fritz Zwicky, right, he was from Switzerland originally, but then he spent some time in California, I guess. So he observed that you have the galaxies, you can observe them with your telescopes, and then you also, by some approach, you can find out the velocities of these galaxies. And he realized that the galaxies move much too fast, and that they cannot be self-bound. So the mass in the galaxies itself is too less to get them, to hold them together. The velocities are too high. So they would never be bound. They would just spread, and they would just separate from each other. And so this was one of the first hints that there must be some dark matter. And so he, at that time in the 30s, he said, well, there's no way around. There must be more than 90% must be in dark matter. Well, okay. And now you have the galaxies. What I wanted to say, you have the galaxies moving around, and they do not collide. So they are just moving like they move. And on the other side, I think, 60 years later, so people became aware that from these groups of galaxies, you get X-ray radiation. And this X-ray radiation is created by the hot gas between the galaxies. And what happens for the gas, this is baryonic matter, and it can collide. And due to this collision, it can radiate. And this is the reason why we see the X-ray, why we can do this X-ray observations. And now there's the difference, or this is what I wanted to point out, is the gas radiates. So it can lose its energy just by radiating, whereas the galaxies, they need to, or they have to move around all the time, and there's no way how they can lose energy. Now, both of them are in these clusters of galaxies. Both of them are in the same region of the universe, and one of them, the baryonic matter, is losing energy, whereas the galaxies and the dark matter does not. And the reason now what's happening is that the baryonic matter contracts a little bit due to the loss of energy, whereas the galaxies cannot do this. And so there's a difference. Of course, there's a difference between the baryons and the dark matter. And now you have a denser baryonic component and a more spread dark matter component. And now the back reaction is that the dark matter component gets a little more contracted, probably, due to the denser baryonic component. But there's a back reaction, but it's really hard to quantify these effects.
So for the time being, we're just not worrying about it in terms of these simulations.
Of course, yes. Let's put it that way. The simulations are not set up to solve this problem. The astronomers are aware of these problems, and you can use other simulations just to investigate this. But that's the Millennium simulation is not the right thing to do this.
So what is the Millennium Simulation going to be used for in comparing to what we can see in the universe?
This is basically the best thing what you can do with this simulation is to compare or to do statistical analysis. So you can compare. Right now there are very ambitious projects, observational projects like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey or 2-degree field. They try to get Sloan try to get 1 million galaxies where you can get the position and the redshift, so you get three-dimensional information of these galaxies. So from observational side, you have a huge amount of data and huge catalogs which are never seen before. And the main thing, or one of the I would say the most interesting thing to do with the Millennium Simulation, is to compare this huge observational catalogs with a data produced in the simulations. So the statistical comparison between state-of-the-art observations and the Millennium Simulation, this is what I think is the most promising thing to do.
Now, the Millennium Simulation, in fact, any simulation, is hardly going to reproduce exactly what we see out in the universe. I mean, we're talking about the large-scale structure of the universe. So we've seen from observations from, as you say, the Sloan Survey of galaxies, galaxies clustered into groups, galaxies strung out in these long filaments. So that overall, the universe has some elements of structure. We've got these long strung out filaments, clusters of galaxies. A simulation is not going to be able to reproduce those exactly, in the sense that we can't look in that direction in the universe and expect, if we look in that direction in our simulation, we see exactly the same thing. So how can we compare the two?
Well, yes, you can compare the observations and the simulations by statistical means. Astronomers like to use the correlation function.
You'll have to explain that one to us.
This is right. So basically what you can do is you can find the nearest neighbor, find the distance, the average distance to the nearest neighbor of a galaxy. So this would be one statistical tool. Now you go to the observations and you look for, you have to constrain yourself to certain type of galaxies. You cannot use all, but let's say we have red galaxies. That's, we have red and blue galaxies in the universe. This is what observation deliver. So we have red and blue galaxies. Now let's focus on the red galaxies. And I ask the question, give me the mean distance to the next red galaxies. So this you could do in observations. So you would just look through your telescope, count, see all the red galaxies, and then measure the distance to the nearest neighbor, the nearest red galaxy. And now you can go to the simulation, to the Millennium Simulation or whatever, and do the same. You have the semi-analytical catalogs, or the semi-analytical approach provides galaxies as well. They have colors as well, let's say red and blue. And now you can go to the simulation and find the next red neighbor for each red galaxy. And now you get an average distance, and you could compare this average distance. So this is a very simplified example for how to compare statistically the observed with a simulated data. So you would get an average distance in observation, average distance in simulations, and if they do agree, then it's better than if it's not agreed.
How close do they have to be before you'll be happy?
This depends on the models, but well, it's a simplified example. You are happy if you can apply other statistical tools, and it provides each agreement provides more evidence that the models you do or the simulations you do are close to reality. It never tells you that you found the right approach, because there could be another approach which just results in similar or in equal measurements. So you're never sure that you have found the right answer, but you're pretty sure that all the wrong answers you can produce are already excluded. So this is the problem about physics in general, that you have a model, you never can prove it, but what you really can do, you can disprove it. But if you have if you have shown then there's agreement between reality and your model in let's say 10 or 20 or whatever measurements or approaches, then you're pretty convinced that this model is not too far from reality. But you have to be careful there. It's a philosophical question, and
we went into that one. Tell us specifically what you do with the Millennium Simulation.
Well, this is I do a comparison between observation, or try to do a comparison between observations and the simulation in a statistical way. And actually, I try to measure this kind of distances. So I try to measure the average distance between galaxies. You have this dark matter halos. This is what you get from the simulation. And you have this semi-analytical approaches. So you know the evolution of each halo, and according to that you set in a galaxy with certain properties. Now, there are two classes of galaxies. One of them are spiral galaxies, the other are elliptical galaxies. Spiral galaxies, the typical shape of spiral galaxies, this is this pancake shape, this strongly is connected to baryonic physics. So that means only if you have electromagnetic cooling and stuff like this, you get this disks or this, but this is not included in the Millennium Simulation, so you have to find a way around how to get this orientation, or you do not know from the first place, you do not know where or how this disk should be oriented in the dark matter halo. And there you need to have you need to get help from other kinds of simulations. These are hydrodynamic simulations, and they can they probably simulate one halo in great detail, but they include the baryonic physics, and so they can find how the evolution of one halo, or the evolution of the dark matter component of this halo, is connected to the evolution of the disk. And they do find that the angular momentum is a good thing probably to connect these two, but there are ambiguities and it's not very clear how to do it. Even if you do this the sophisticated hydrodynamic simulations, it's not very clear how to connect the angular momentum of the dark matter to the angular momentum of the baryonic matter, which is responsible for the orientation of the disk. So this is very difficult to get an orientation for a disk galaxy in a Millennium Simulation is a hard task. You can do it statistically. You can say, well, we don't know exactly, but we know it with some uncertainty, and so we do it in a statistical approach. And this is what maybe is the most promising way to go. For me, this seems to be not well justified, or it's very hard to handle this kind of problems. So there's another type of galaxies. These are the elliptical galaxies. The elliptical galaxies also, they contain stars, and stars are baryons and made of baryons. So again, you would think that this is very much involved with baryonic physics. But the idea of elliptical galaxies is that they, or how they form, is that they merge, that there are two proto-galaxies, let's say that these are spiral galaxies or whatever, they merge, and then they form this particular elliptical shape. And the nice thing about this merging process, or that the elliptical galaxies are formed by merging, is that this is related to collisionless physics. And collisionless physics has nothing to do with the baryons. So that the special thing about baryons is that they collide. And if they collide, they radiate, or they do things which only baryons can do. But now, if we look at the evolution or the formation of elliptical galaxies, there are spiral galaxies which collide, and they do not radiate. They follow collisionless physics, and that's the reason why I have the feeling that the orientation or the properties of elliptical galaxies are closer related to the dark matter halo as it is for spiral galaxies. For spiral galaxies, they are really, this is a thing of baryons, whereas the elliptical galaxies later on, which form by merging, they are probably more related, or again, they are closer to the dark matter. They behave closer to the dark matter, and the reason is why the process of formation is collisionless physics. So this is the reason why I think elliptical galaxies are good. The orientation of elliptical galaxies probably are, I can dig out the orientation of elliptical galaxies in the Millennium simulation, even if there is no baryonic physics included. And now what I do next is, if I have an idea how to assign an orientation of these elliptical galaxies to the semi-analytical galaxies, I mean, from the semi-analytics I get colors and I get the stellar mass and all this stuff, but they do not get the orientations. So now I try to get the orientation. This is my part. I try to get this orientation of only of elliptical galaxies, because I don't know how to deal with spiral galaxies. Now, if I have this orientation of elliptical galaxies, then I can relate, or I can see what does the overall galaxy distribution do compared or with reference to this orientation of the elliptical galaxies. And this I can measure. I can measure what is the probability to find a galaxy along the line of the orientation of this elliptical galaxies, or with a little opening angle and a little cone. Let's say I can predict the number of normal average galaxy, which I would find along the orientation of this elliptical galaxies. And so I get a number out of this. So I, with all my thinking and all this, information from the Millennium simulation, I can get a number. I can say, well, along the line, along the orientation of elliptical galaxies, you will find 20 other galaxies within, let's say, a few hundred million light years. So if you have a cone, a few hundred million light years long, you will find a certain amount of galaxies. And this is a number which I can get from the simulation. And this number, again, I can compare to observations. Hmm.
So out of the observations, the Sloan data, you've got your little cone of observation, your line of sight through the universe. You can count up how many galaxies you see of an elliptical nature, orientated at a certain position angle, presumably, because you can observe that, you can see that. You then compare the same thing with the same observation, so to speak, in the Millennium simulation, because you've learned how to assign a elliptical galaxy from your family of analytic models into the halos of the Millennium simulation, and you know how to orient them.
Right.
In the Millennium simulation. So then you can, you observe, in inverted commas, the orientation of elliptical galaxies in the Millennium simulation, find out how many galaxies are orientated at a certain position angle, and compare that number of galaxies to what you actually observe in the Sloan data.
Right. Mm. You're right.
So how have you done? What's the result? Do they agree?
Yes, they do agree. We, so far, this is work in progress. We get really nice agreement. So the signal looks pretty much the same. We are not sure whether the amplitude of the signal, whether this is, modeled correctly. So there we have to do some more work to see, because as I said, it's not clear how to connect the orientations of galaxies to the connections of dark matter halos. And even if I do this approach with them focusing on the central parts of the dark matter halo to get the orientations of this elliptical galaxies, then it's not really clear whether this is the absolutely correct way to do it. And as I said, there are no baryons in the Millennium simulation. So whether there could be other processes which have an influence on the final final orientation of an elliptical galaxy, and this is just not included in the dark matter simulation.
Well, as a start, though, it sounds like you're doing fantastic work, and it seems to be that you're matching up the best known simulation of the universe with the real one. So congratulations on that, and we look forward to hearing more about it.
Thank you.
And thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for being here. It was a pleasure to have this conversation.